Rhiannon, if you were to explain to me what diabetes is in 15 seconds, how would you do that? Three, two, one, go.
It's a lot of pressure. Okay, so from what I know, I would say it's something to do with insulin and some problem that goes wrong with regulation of insulin. And that's the 15 seconds I can fill.
You did impressively well in 12 seconds. That's amazing. Science. Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Science Basement Podcast, a podcast for people who love all things science. I'm your host, Giuliano.
And I'm your co-host, Rhiannon.
And today we are in the amazing Audi Library in Helsinki for our first real-life recording.
Yeah, it's very excited. We've got
I know, right?
all the gear on, and hopefully some idea.
Okay, and today we're going to talk about a disease that I thought I knew. You know, we always hear about diabetes, right? Like, I was impressed from how you explained it amazingly in 12 seconds, but I would have not been able to do that. So today we're going to talk about diabetes and some future treatment, possible treatments. And to guide us through this topic, we have Tom Barsby, one of the most British people I know, postdoc researcher at the lab of Timo Odonkoski, University of Helsinki. Hello, Tom. How are you today?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me at this incredible studio that you've built that I assume you know like the back of your hand.
Yes. I feel at home here. I mean, you, when I said you're one of the most British researchers I know, and Rhiannon, you as well. Like, there's Richard
British
Dawkins.
Episode.
Yes, there's
Yes.
Richard Dawkins
Yeah.
in my hierarchy, and then there's Tom and Rhiannon.
Look, just because we're sitting here drinking tea,
I actually do have a cup.
Rhiannon has a cup of tea. So if you hear some, that's Rhiannon. Anyway, Audi Library will kick us out very soon,
Yeah.
so we need to get on with the episode. So Tom, you work on diabetes, roughly. Not roughly. I mean, I know that you're not what directly in diabetes, but you work on something related to diabetes, and we'll get to what you do. But first, would you mind giving us a brief but clear explanation of what diabetes is?
I can certainly try. So diabetes is kind of a catch-all term for a metabolic disease where you lose the ability to, in essence, control your blood glucose levels.
Right. And I always hear that there's this kind of type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes. What's with that?
It's true. There's actually a few more, and if you
What? The different
yes,
okay.
it's
the
getting
famous
complicated.
ones are one
The
and two.
biggies,
The
the
biggies.
biggies. Yeah. So basically the prime mover of all diabetes is, in principle, either the death or dysfunction or the lack of getting them in the first place of a cell called the beta cell
Right.
in your pancreas that secretes insulin.
The beta cells, like, they're going to be the main characters of our episodes.
They spoilers. They will be. Yeah.
Can you, who are they? Oh, who are they? What are they?
So they're a hormone-secreting cell that you have in clusters in your pancreas, and they're part of your endocrine system. So in essence, they sense the blood glucose in your blood after a meal or mainly meals. I don't know, unless you're having,
unless you're injecting
unless you're,
sugar in
yeah,
your
unless
blood.
You're doing the whole, like, you're just really smashing sugar injections for no reason.
Exactly. Or drinking sugary drinks.
Of course, yes. That's the other one that I was about to
Yes.
say. And they, in response to this, they release a hormone called insulin, which tells other tissues in your body to basically take up glucose from your blood, store it, or use it. And so if you don't have the beta cells, you can't produce insulin. And generally, you're more likely to then to have a blood glucose level that's too high. It's sort of dangerously high. And this kind of leads to diabetic problems.
Okay, so from what I know, going back to type 1 and type 2.
Which we still don't understand what they are.
Yeah, so
okay.
Type 1, from my understanding, is normally when you're something that you are born with, in quotation marks, or you kind of have at a young age. And type 2 is more related to diet. Or, you know, develops at an older age. So can you kind of correct me if I'm wrong?
No, that yeah. I mean, for the most part, that is, yeah, very, very
Okay.
true. So type 1 is, as you say, you're more likely to acquire it when you're a child. it's basically more likely to be genetically associated. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of classified as sort of an autoimmune reaction to your own beta cells. So through, I'll just say, largely unknown mechanisms, because it's kind of still vaguely disputed, but your body decides to attack your own beta cells.
Your immune system decides to attack. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So instead of, say, you can get developmental problems where your beta cells are never made in the first place. Uh-huh. So theoretically, you can get diabetes before you're even born, right? You can have these things. Type 1 is when you have this kind of autoimmune attack, so your mm-hmm. body kind of rejects and fights your own beta cells. So you obviously, if you don't have beta cells, you can't make insulin. And then type 2, although there are genetic predispositions, or at least people looking for markers, or at least things that will bias you for acquiring type 2, for the most part, it's largely a lifestyle thing. So if you stress your beta cells for long enough, so if you have a high sugar diet, high carb diet, low levels of exercise, generally speaking, over that protracted period, it's not that your beta cells are under attack, but through so much overuse, and then your body can become insensitive to the insulin the beta cells produce, and it's kind of this feedback cycle of stress that ultimately leads to beta cell loss.
Yeah, so to clarify, type 1, you can't produce the insulin from the beta cells.
Well,
a bit more complicated.
You can still, I mean, theoretically, yes, they can. I mean, your beta cells are in many ways still functional, but they're, for some reason, they stimulate this attack on themselves.
Right.
And there are certain genetic mutations that predispose to type 1, but it's mediated by an autoimmune response.
Okay.
So theoretically, in both type 1 and type 2, like you can still secrete insulin. Mm-hmm. Like your beta cells are theoretically up to a point fine, but the method of how they die is kind of what separates type 1 and type 2.
So to summarize, roughly, type 1 is more genetic based, and type 2 is a lifestyle caused disease, kind of with some genetic influences. Is that correct?
That's a very diplomatic answer, and I agree with it. As a catch-all, yes, okay. That's accurate.
Okay, so we have type 1, type 2, so either genetic or lifestyle. Your beta cells, which are cells in your pancreas, which produce insulin in response to sugar. So for one reason or another, they stop working. And why is that a problem?
Well, this kind of leads to all the sort of diabetic sort of outcomes. So it's very bad to have too much fuel floating around your body consistently.
Okay.
Obviously, so sugar is a very reactive molecule, we burn it for energy.
Yes.
So if it's just sort of floating around constantly, it obviously reacts with a lot of molecules floating around. So this can lead to a lot of problems with like capillaries, so very fine blood vessels. So when people, basically you get cell death in your extremities, you can go blind. These are kind of very protracted diabetic. It basically burns away a lot of tissues just because you have this very
sugar
rich,
floating.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you want that sugar to be taken away from the blood and stored in the cells to have a healthy...
So.
Okay. So, okay, this is the disease. What I understood is now that we have the beta cells, which are our main characters, and either in type 1 or type 2, anyway, for any reason, they stop working properly. So what are the treatments that we have nowadays for this disease?
Well, as you can imagine, the predominant one is insulin.
Yeah.
So insulin.
I imagine that.
Injection. Yeah, you're ahead of me. You're ahead of me on this deduction. But yeah, so the absence of the cells that produce insulin, well, we can produce insulin in large quantities. And as long as you sort of self-monitor, like after a meal, you can give yourself insulin injections and try and keep your blood glucose in this kind of Goldilocks zone of not too high, not too low. Because obviously you can theoretically overdo it. You don't want blood glucose to dip too low. There's, if you want a bit more high tech, there are now sort of consistent blood glucose monitors, which means that you don't have to prick your finger every so often. You can have a more real-time kind of look of how your blood glucose is doing, and then tailor the insulin injections to that.
Is it those kind of plasters or tags that people have on their arms?
So you probably see I don't know if this is a particular brand, but like so the white circles on the usually on the backs of people's
arms. I always
arms.
Thought they were like this kind of nicotine thing.
Maybe there's a double sort of one.
Insulin and tobacco.
Yeah.
I mean, and nicotine
together at last.
So it is, and but I understand that there's no actual cure, right? You're never fully cured of diabetes.
Bringing out the C word.
Sorry,
the other C word.
Yeah,
for scientists. Cure is a very tricky, tricky thing. So the best case that we've come to, as in, how can you basically get away from insulin injections, which is obviously the closest thing to a quality of life cure,
sure,
you're saying, is there are islet transplantations, so beta cell transplantations, where you would take beta cells from a donor and you can inject them into, theoretically, a diabetic.
So wait, you get a healthy person, right?
Who's died.
That makes sense. A dead
healthy person.
That makes sense. Okay, so you get someone without diabetes, so you know, a person in which beta cells work properly. You take those beta cells, healthy, and you transplant them into the diabetic patient to replace the malfunctioning beta cells, correct?
Yeah, so pretty much along the line of any organ transplant, right? You take a functioning organ from a donor, and you put it into someone that's either has that diseased organ or lacks the tissue. So in a diabetic's case, yeah, if you've lost these beta cells, then these act as kind of pretty much a one-to-one organ transplant-esque kind of replacement.
Right.
The problem being is you have the same issues of other organ transplants, sort of immune rejection. It's not implanted in the same kind of spot. There's a particular surgery that has to be done, and more importantly, it takes more than one donor to cure. I'm doing air quotes when I say cure.
Very useful person in a podcast.
I know, yeah. So that's what, but if I just lean and go, I'm using air quotes. So it can take like two or three donors to have enough beta cells to actually cure one person.
Okay.
And there are like follow-up studies. The main problem when it comes to transplantation things like this is, because of potential immune rejection, you're on immunosuppressants forever, or as long as you want.
Of course, to prevent your immune system to reject the implant. Oh, okay.
Yes. And so obviously then the big problem is that you want to cure a disease that primarily, you know, if you want to put in these cells, primarily affects very young children, and you can't really, I mean, you cannot put a small child on immunosuppressants for the rest of their life. It shreds liver, kidneys. It's very, very bad. So this is kind of the big kind of hurdle that you can, you know, air quotes, cure a type 1 diabetic, but they've been self-monitoring for potentially decades before they, you know, get these surgeries.
And the question following up with the organ transplantation theme, with these cells, how long do they then last within the patient? Because, like, as I would understand, the cells themselves can't divide and regenerate. So is it a very short transplantation process, like length of cure?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting to the period now that we're only now at these kind of long-term studies, because the first patients weren't done that long ago. So one of the big hurdles is actually purifying the beta cells. So getting them out of a donor can be quite tough, right? These are cells that are buried within an organ, surrounded by tissue that you definitely don't want to implant in someone else. And it's pretty rough. This is why it takes numerous patients to get enough cells to cure, well, to at least implant in a patient. And the problem is more getting the material and keeping the material alive prior to transplantation rather than, but there'll be no regenerative effect. So these are cells that don't divide. And basically what you put in is theoretically what you'll get.
And ideally that they will be in the patient forever until, ideally.
In an ideal world.
So is it solved? That's it? Like, because it sounds like, you implant healthy beta cells into a patient who doesn't have healthy beta cells, and there you go. I presume that's not it.
It is completely solved. No, it gets a bit trickier just because of, again, the economies of you need to have maybe two or three donors per one person to potentially cure. And so it's an issue of yield. It's an issue of immune tolerance and things like that. So I wouldn't say that it's going to be a widespread cure that everyone could sign up for. So I would say no, that isn't the end of this.
So it sounds like a far from ideal kind of treatment. Is there any way of making or producing these cells in the lab?
It's great that you've mentioned that. So that is pretty much, yes, what our lab is.
Does it happen to be what you were?
I can't believe it. In a monumental coincidence that has happened. Yes. So my research in our lab is predominantly based on generating beta cells from stem cells. So these could act as another basically inexhaustible cell source for beta cell replacement. And also we can then use these to study beta cells. So not only use them to potentially cure diabetes, but understand what's going wrong in the first place, just in the dish.
Okay, wait a minute. So you mentioned, so you're trying to create beta cells from stem cells. Now, stem cells are cells that can turn in, they don't have an identity yet, and they have the potential to become several different types of cells, right?
Yeah, that's true. So we use a particular type of stem cell that theoretically will grow forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we have basically an infinite supply,
okay,
theoretically.
Because they keep regenerating in your petri dish.
So we can just keep them growing for as long as we want and then freeze them.
Okay.
And then also when we want to turn them into other cells, such as beta cells, then we can.
Okay.
And how long does this process take to go from the stem cells to the beta cells?
So to get to a stage of beta cells where they're functional, where we know that they're actually acting like beta cells, takes about a month and a half,
okay,
maybe 2 months.
In the dish?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have the stem cell, you just thawed your stem cells from your freezer or whatever, and you do whatever scientific magic you have to, and it takes a month before they become something close to a beta cell.
Probably a bit longer if we're taking them from the freezer as well.
Okay.
So it all adds up. So, I mean, it's definitely not a short process, but we... As with all these things, we're trying to trick the cells into doing something that would take them 15 months in real human time, right?
So is that it then? Can you use these lab-grown beta cells and put them directly into the patient?
So yes and no. So theoretically,
always good answer.
I love that. Biology is always so simple.
I like to be even-handed and vague, as if I'm on trial. No comment.
A scientist and a British person. Perfect combination.
he's so non-committal. I love it. So yeah, so this is technically yes, although there are some caveats to it. So the beta cells that we make in the lab have all the right markers, like what we would assign characteristics of beta cells. Mm-hmm. So we know that they look the right way, they express the right factors that we would expect.
Wait for it.
But I can't believe it. But they have slight differences to, let's say, the real thing, the real deal beta cells.
So they look like beta cells, but they're not quite?
This is when biology becomes quite murky, right? So you can have particular genes, like switched on, that make a certain cell. Like,
right.
So a heart cell has heart cell genes.
Mm-hmm.
A beta cell has beta cell genes. The problem arises if you want the cell to actually do a particular job, right? So a heart cell is only really a heart cell if it's beating. A beta cell is only a beta cell if it's listening.
Sorry, yes, that was a terrible joke.
Yeah, we've definitely done something wrong with the differentiation if our beta cells are beating.
Easy way of knowing.
It's like, well, this is not good. This is not good. But yes, so when we say, are these cells mature? So are they doing the right job as the real deal cells? So could they sense the blood glucose and release insulin in a controlled, dynamic, real-time way?
Okay, you define this stage mature.
Yeah.
When
so,
they are actually resembling the real deal properly.
Okay. So yeah, it's not that they have this set of what we would call as markers, so like, you know, these certain check marks that we look for to say, okay, they're definitely this type of cell. Are they now one step beyond? Are they maturing? Are they doing the job of the cell that they look like? Right?
Okay.
They're not just dormant. Mm-hmm. They're not. You know, it looks like a duck, but does it also walk and quack like a duck?
Fair enough. That's we
want these
clear.
To quack.
That's beautifully clear. All right. So they're not. Do they ever mature then? Do they ever quack?
So, in theory, yes. It just takes a bit of time.
How much time are we talking about?
Well, when we've done these studies in mice, it takes maybe 2 to 3 months.
Okay.
For them to what we would like term humanize. So a mouse blood glucose level and a human blood glucose level is a bit different. Mm. But if we give them human cells, we can set it to kind of a human level. So they're obviously responding to the level of blood glucose that they expect to see and are controlling for that. So it's this kind of window of time then of what is happening during this kind of maturation process. Mm. So, and it's worth pointing out, like, so certain companies are using stem cell beta cells as a potential therapy. Like, so they're implanting these cells in patients very low numbers.
So some people are actually already trying this in clinics, implanting lab-grown beta cells in patients.
Yes. So it's pretty low level. Okay. It's pretty early days, I would say. But there are some promising results.
Right.
But, well, as it was reported in the New York Times, which is where I go for all my scientific information, and of course the Science Basement podcast.
Good plug.
Yeah, so it's very early days, I would say, for these clinical trials. Some have been published with, let's say, mixed results. And then again, you still have the same problem of immune rejection and, mm-hmm. you know, how you deliver these cells, how you keep them alive post-transplantation. But yeah, so what we're kind of focused on in this is then if we're putting in these beta cells that we know aren't as mature as they could be, is there maybe not a danger, but is there a possibility that maybe they're responding to things other than blood glucose? Are they releasing insulin in non-mature ways that would make these transplants kind of...
So that's a concern.
It's one of the things... Well, I mean, you always have a concern when you're doing any sort of stem cell-based...
Of course. But what I mean is transplant. So it is a thing that it's a risk that if you happen to transplant beta cells or lab-grown beta cells, they are not fully mature. So they look like beta cells, but they're not quite... So they don't quack yet. Mm-hmm. They might behave in a way that you don't want them
to
behave.
Cluck.
That's
exactly
the title of my next paper cluck. has been picked in this very room.
Okay, so that's an issue. Like, is this the limitation for the use of lab grown beta cells in patients? Is that the problem?
I wouldn't say it's a problem, but it's something to definitely make sure isn't a problem.
Okay.
Just for widespread use, because obviously it comes down to the people making the cells. It's like some of these procedures that can make beta cells, some are better than others, obviously. So the quality of the end product could be kind of different. And you want to make sure that if you're obviously doing a clinical cure, or at least on the way to a cure, you want to make sure that you want to implant close to 1-to-1
for the organ.
Because you don't, I mean, if you were waiting a kidney transplant or a liver transplant, ideally you don't want to wait 3 months for that to start working.
Yeah. So. So is there a way of making this process of maturation more efficient?
So this is kind of what we're looking at. So when we implant the beta cells, we can study them after they've been implanted for a certain amount of time. So we can put them in mice as our sort of experimental model. We can see how they change metabolically over time, and we can look at particular proteins, genes, markers, and if we know at what point in the maturation process, like after they're implanted, that they gain certain traits, the hope is then that we can trick them when they're in the dish into thinking that they've been in a mouse for 3 months. So we can learn, so we know that they do mature post-implantation, and then the holy grail is what can we learn about the beta cells post-implantation, and then use that and then trick them into thinking that they've been in a mouse for 3 months in the dish.
Oh, so what you want to do is you want that maturation process that would happen in the patient's body, you want it to happen in the dish already. So when you implant them in the patient, they're ready to go.
We want a fake quack.
I was about to say, they're ready to quack.
I've ruined the joke. I'm sorry.
And this is what you're working on.
Yes.
And how is it going? Can you tell us a bit of some results, or can you tell us anything?
I wish for death. it's super, super interesting. So we're sort of approaching this from a different angle from other labs where we're looking at kind of the metabolism directly of the beta cells and then trying to kind of learn what the control points are from that. So how they respond to different fuels. So we can give them sugars, which they should respond to, and we can give them other things that they should be blind to. But if they're still active to these compounds that they should be blind to, then that's a sign of immaturity.
Okay, that's bad.
It's very bad. Yeah. Because you don't want your beta cells to release insulin to any other
salt, for example.
That would be very, very bad news for it.
So you want to make sure that in your petri dish, they only respond to the sugar and they don't respond to something else, like again, salt or whatever.
Yes, pretty much. So we're kind of at the stage of more like understanding what a true stem cell beta cell can look like post implantation. Okay. And now we're kind of at that cusp of, okay, well, can we be cheeky? Are there any sort of commercial molecules that we can put in to boost certain pathways, inhibit certain pathways? Can we do this kind of tricking into, you know, if you can force glucose to be burnt in a particular way or things to be not burnt in a particular way, does everything then fall into place?
Okay. So you're trying to force and accelerate these stem cells to become mature beta cells in your petri dish.
Yes. Yeah.
So the penultimate question. This season of The Science Basement, we're kind of discussing this idea of the intersection across fields of research. So I'm kind of wondering, your work kind of seems to me a clear example of the intersection between molecular biology and medicine. Do you think that this interaction between the two fields is a benefit in your case?
I would say it depends on your view to capitalism and how that comes into medicine.
Oh, here we go.
Are we going there?
I shall begin my 25-minute tirade. It's been a tricky area to study anyway, just because insulin as a product is very, very profitable, let's say.
Uh-huh.
So this generation of potential therapies and cures, let's say certain companies haven't exactly been, you know, trying to champion it.
It's because they can sell insulin for profit. So why develop something new?
So it's kind of it's nice now that there are sort of companies more focused on pushing this forward as a viable kind of therapy. So in that instance, it's been fantastic because obviously then we're already working pretty closely with clinicians anyway to get like the real deal beta cell samples to do our experiments on, and then also that there's already these protocols set up to actually do, you know, beta cell transplantations and things like that. So on one side, it's you're fighting one hand and then, you know, hoping that they help you with the other. There's still kind of hurdles. So I think it will take sort of a more concerted effort from both kind of clinicians, industry and academia just to solve problems. Like the biggie is still sort of immune rejection, right? So, but if you theoretically can make these beta cells from the patient's own stem cells, can you then sort of alleviate that? Can you?
Oh yeah, of course, because in that case, the immune system would not recognize those cells as something foreign because they come from the same body.
Yep.
So that makes sense.
A quick interruption. We need your help. Love the podcast? Wish the episodes were 10 minutes shorter or want to hear more about a particular topic? You can now let us know. Fill out the 5-minute questionnaire found in the episode description to give us your feedback. 5 minutes is all it takes to make your favorite podcast even better. Negative reviews are also welcome. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of your episode.
I believe we have some questions from the audience.
Yes,
or
we do.
I think we have one.
We have one question that's been submitted from the audience.
You want to read it?
Yes, I can. So we have been asked, could this method also help people suffering from pancreatic cancer?
I would have to say pretty much indirectly, probably not.
Okay.
Just because it is technically the same organ. But obviously these are very, very different, disparate problems. Pancreatic cancers are incredibly harsh. But the short answer is kind of no, in essence. Even though it is affecting the same organ, just the overall prognosis of each disease is...
And it's a different kind of process that goes wrong.
Yes, in very, very different and opposing ways, pretty much.
Yeah, science is complicated. That's my summary.
That should always be your take home.
But I don't think we have said the name of the person who sent us the question. My apologies for that. But anyway, thank you for submitting that question. I really appreciate that. Tom, thank you so much. Best of luck with your research. We really need that. You know, we really need this technique to turn stem cells into perfectly working and quacking beta cells, ready to go, ready to be implanted into patient, and ideally directly from the patient themselves. Okay, now we're almost at the end of the episode. Rhiannon, my lovely co-host, what's your fun fact for
today? So this fun fact is couldn't be more of a tangent from the episode.
It always is. It always is.
I'm on
so
the edge
bear
of my
with
seat.
Me because I'm setting the scene. So in the UK, as Tom, I hope he knows, we have one of our most kind of treasured person, Sir David Attenborough. And recently this new, and he basically, for those who don't know who he is, he's produces these incredible nature programs. And recently the last, this autumn, this Frozen Planet 2 has come out and I would recommend it watching. And in this, there was a really cool clip. And basically what it is these animals called painted turtles. And what they basically do, they hatch in autumn, unlike not in spring, like most animals. And then because they're in Canada, very cold, very similar to Finland, they basically freeze. So they're born and then they just freeze and their heart stops working, but their brain works at a very low function.
So some form of hibernation.
Yes, kind of some form of hibernation.
Uh-huh.
And then come spring, the sun comes out, the snow starts to melt and the turtles start to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big advantage for them because they then can get the first food in the forest, etc. And this is just very interesting way of this creature kind of being born, because it's basically born into to being frozen.
Huh.
I think you're just describing my life on a yearly basis.
This is the life of someone in Finland.
So I'm basically freezing right now. I'm amazed I've got through this interview.
But yeah, we can put the YouTube video. There's a clip in the show notes because I would really recommend going watching it. Because it's very interesting. These turtles look very dead and then they start moving. So it's a great story all round.
But do they just lay there?
They literally, I'm going to have to audio-visual describe.
Yes, yeah.
They lay there with their flippers in the air. They're like in the nest. They just look like they've died in the nest. And they're just lying there with some snow on them.
They're literally covered on snow.
Yeah, there's ice all around them, and then they just kind of,
oh my god,
kind of come back to life and start moving and open their eyes.
And then they basically thaw.
Yeah, they thaw. The spring.
What a terrifying way to enter the world.
But
I love that.
But yeah,
what's your thoughts about this?
I just got distracted by the idea of cute baby turtles, and then you went on this frozen tangent. And I was like, oh well, they're probably fine. I hope they come back in the spring.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So let's put the link of the YouTube link in the description so everyone can watch it. I think that's it. Mostly because the Audi Library is about to kick us out in 5 minutes, so we really have to close the episode. Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for being here with us and explaining to us.
No, thank you. Thank you for the invite. It's been a hell of a time here at the Science and Basement Podcast Studios. I'll spend another hour in your Japanese gardens. I might pop to the spa. But no, thank you.
Thank you, Rhiannon, for being an amazing co-host and for your lovely fun fact. And thank you to everyone listening. I'm Giuliano Di Dio. This was the Science Basement Podcast. See you in the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. The Science Basement.
If you liked this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate us on the podcasting app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. If you're interested in getting involved or being interviewed, get in touch at podcast@thesciencebasement.org.